It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, Governor Walker announced yesterday that he is interested in consolidating some state agencies during the coming year. And we'll take a look at the possibilities.
First, recent high-profile police-related deaths in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City, and even in Milwaukee are raising questions about how police do their jobs.
But police officers and police advocacy groups say the public lacks a fundamental understanding of the way that cops are trained to respond to imminent threats to life and safety. We've invited James Lewis to shed some light on how police officers approach their work, especially when it comes to situations involving the use of deadly force. James is the interim chief of police at the Appleton Police Department. And Chief Lewis, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start out with some of the basics. If I was going to be a new police officer these days, what sorts of training, what's the basic training that I have to go through and to deal with the matters of force and imminent danger and that sort of thing?
Well, I think you really have to even step back further than that, because it starts before you're hired. We take a hard look at your history, your background, to see if you've had any issues of violence. We give you a psychological test. We give you a polygraph, because we're trying to weed out those tendencies. But once you're all hired by us, then in the academy is where it starts, and you're giving a series of training to that go all the way from sometimes referred to as verbal judo, where you use the ability to talk people down, talk them into compliance, all the way up to the shooting at the range. And of course, that gets the most attention because it's the more glamorous TV-type stuff. But really, much more time is spent on interpersonal skills, how you deal with people. More and more, what you see among agencies, which you did not see when I started 44 years ago, is a lot of training on crisis intervention techniques. We put a lot of our officers through classes 40 hours a year, just on the issue of how you handle people with a variety of different mental health issues, because every one of those issues may need to be treated in a different way. And so we do our best to make the officers be able to identify what the issue is with people they're dealing with.
So you brought up that you've been in the business for 44 years, and I just have to ask, is it fair to compare a police officer's training today in 2014 to the training they may have received 44 years ago?
No, there's no comparison. 44 years ago, it was much more condensed, much more, frankly, I would say militaristic. I think when we talk about being more militarized, I think we've actually went the opposite direction. We didn't do very little with the issue of mental health in those days. We didn't do much with the idea of reaching out and trying to help kids in jeopardy in school. We didn't have school liaison officers. We didn't have cadet programs or explorer programs. We didn't have shop with a cop. We weren't even graded or judged on how involved we are in the community. We were really judged on responding to calls and how many calls we handled. Well, now we put much more emphasis on the people skills and what they're doing in the community. We didn't even talk about that 44 years ago.
So the training we were talking about just a few seconds ago, that all takes place before an officer even puts on a uniform and goes out on a patrol.
Yes, that takes place in the basic academy, which can be anywhere from about 16 weeks to 26, 28 weeks. And once that's completed, then they go through what's generally called a field training officer program, which is about another half a year. So most police officers are never on their own for at least a year from the time they're hired. And all these skills are retrained every year. We do what we call defensive tactics once a year. Every year the officers go through a whole new series of. And it can be anything from, different types of holds we use, to use of taser, to back to the verbal skills. And then many agencies train on the range with firearms about every 3 months. So the training never stops, and it's required by most states that you do have to be certified on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's a question I wanted to ask about. How standardized is this across, like in Wisconsin, for example, across town police departments, city police departments, county police departments, that sort of thing?
Within a state, it's very standardized. The state sets requirements, and you have to complete the basic training that's required by the state, and then they have recertification that has to be done, no matter whether you're a one- or two-person township or your Milwaukee PD, you have these set requirements. Now, it is different state by state, and it can be dramatically different in different states. But within once, most states have what they call a police and standards and training commission that sets these kind of requirements, and then you have to comply with those to keep your certification.
So states always like to compare themselves to other states. So here in Wisconsin, in terms of the standards that we have in place here, do we rank towards the top, the middle, the bottom? How do you see it?
Well, it's in Wisconsin, they require entry-level police officers have to have 60 college units, where a lot of states only require that you have a high school or GED. So I would say the officers enter here with at least a higher level of education. Sometimes the academies are shorter here than they are in other states, and that may be because the other states have to do a lot more writing skills-type training in their academies because they're bringing people in with less education. But on the other hand, some of the other states, I think, might be ahead of Wisconsin in the area of mandated training. When you become a supervisor, you have to take X number of hours, management X number of hours. Some of them have a more structured career development than we have here in Wisconsin. Those also has gotten a lot better, and it's better than many states. But there are some that are, I think, probably better.
So let's turn to an officer with that training out on the street, dealing with a difficult situation. If you could just like pick a common situation, a traffic stop or something like that, and talk about some of the things that officer is looking for and how they deal with the situation should it begin to escalate.
Well, being on a traffic stop, the officer is always concerned about keeping the person visible to him, keeping their hands in sight, worried about those kind of things. Are they under the influence of anything? Are they having any mental illness problems? Are they having domestic problems that may be out of control? So you're looking for some behavioral issues about how they're responding to you, the demeanor. And it can go up and down. You know, I've seen cases that were very calm that went from 0 to 100 for almost no reason. And I've had others where people were very agitated at the beginning of a stop, and by the end they're wanting to shake hands because things went well. So there is just no standard traffic stop, as there's no standard domestic violence incident. Everyone is different, and the officer's got to try to get a good handle on the totality of everything going on around them.
All right, lots to talk about, and we're going to be continuing this conversation in just a few moments. We're talking with James Lewis about what he thinks we need to know about the police use of force in certain situations. He is the interim chief of police at the Appleton Police Department.
And we'd like to invite you to join this conversation. What questions do you have about police tactics and training? Is there something that you've wanted to ask about how police approach their job but you never had the chance? Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org.
Coming up, we'll be taking your calls. At first, it is time for the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end membership drive. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here with Cheryl Gasser, and we are here to help ask for your support for your radio station. That's listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. And right now, during this drive, it is your chance to make sure that we're all set to start 2015 in good financial shape. Now, you've made Wisconsin Public Radio programs possible as we head into the new year, and you can continue to do that when you make your pledge at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Hey, Gene, a quick update here. Last hour, we heard from 10 members, including two brand new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you all so much for your support. And now, this hour, the first hour today of Central Time, we are looking for 15 pledges.
All right, 15. We can do that before 4 o'clock, and we will need your help to get there. And you'll want to make that donation to support the station you love. And because your gift of any amount automatically enters you into a drawing for 2 tickets on a WPR trip. So you can help meet this goal, and at the same time, you'll be entered into this drawing when you give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
I'm quite sure that you found yourself thinking about something in a new way after listening to Central Time. That is really the beauty of this show and a lot of the shows on the Ideas Network. You get to hear multiple points of view on a variety of topics and make up your own mind. Because you value what you hear on Central Time and on Wisconsin Public Radio, pledge your support now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just as Cheryl said, you give to WPR to support the programs that you love. And as an added incentive, we've got something even more special for you during this year-end membership drive. It is a limited edition 2015 calendar, a paper calendar, one of those old ones that you hang on the wall. They're really cool and retro-looking. It's all yours when you give $120 or more, just $10 a month.
It is a really nice-looking calendar. It features historic black-and-white photos of WPR in the early days. You can ask for the calendar as your thank-you gift when you make a pledge of $10 a month or more. How do you do it? WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This membership drive, we're having a drawing for a trip of your choice to D.C., France, or Alaska. When you give, you're automatically entered. You don't have to pledge to participate. You can send a postcard with your name, address, email, and phone number to WPR Trip Drawing, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Enter by sending a postcard, or better yet, by making a pledge right now.
You can make your pledge by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 as part of our year-end membership drive. Hi, I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here with Cheryl Gasser, and we're both here asking for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's your gift of $10 or $15 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount.
And since we launched our Sustainer program, thousands of members have made the switch to providing a steady, reliable stream of support to WPR by making those automatic monthly gifts. That security does come with benefits, both for you and for Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's absolutely right. So, for example, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we can focus more of our resources on programming that you can listen to. And then from the sustaining member perspective, you don't have to remember to renew your membership every year because it automatically rolls over. So it is a win-win. Become a sustaining member today at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 with a gift of $10 a month or whatever amount you choose.
Help us reach our hourly goal. By 4 o'clock, we'd like to hear from 15 members. And we recently had a listener write in to say, I love people coming together in community to support WPR. Well, thank you so much for that comment.
Yes, and we hear comments like that all the time, and they are very gratifying. We agree that membership drives are a great time for you. And frankly, they're a great time for us as well to share our enthusiasm for the programs and the services that we all love. So join the community in celebrating WPR. Make your pledge right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Now, if you've never given to Wisconsin Public Radio before because you don't think you can give enough to make a difference, well, think again. Listener donations make up the single largest piece of our budget. Let me say that again. Listener donations make up the single largest piece of our budget. But that doesn't mean that we're asking you for a huge gift.
No, in fact, we're not. In fact, many first-time donors give $5 a month for their WPR listening. That's just $60 a year. But here's the thing. You get to decide the amount that works for you, and then you make that gift, whatever the amount. They are all welcome, and they are all appreciated at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Help to keep Central Time and Wisconsin Public Radio strong as we enter a new year of 2015. Become a first-time donor or make an extra year-end gift to support the programs that you value, like Central Time. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And don't forget, we've got that goal we are looking at before 4 o'clock. We need to get 11 more pledges in the door. And that, I have to say, is very, very doable. But we are going to need your help to get there. And don't forget, as an added bonus at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552, we'll enter you into that drawing for two tickets on a WPR trip. And if you're a sustaining member, you're all set because you will be automatically entered.
And if you're not already a sustainer, why don't you become one right now? It's an easy thing to do. It's very convenient. You set up ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card. Do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Don't forget to be counted in 2014. Your pledge right now is very important. Make that pledge online at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552, and thank you.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're back with James Lewis. He is the interim chief of police at the Appleton Police Department, and we are taking your calls.
What questions do you have about the decision-making and training of police officers in your community? What do you wish you knew more about when it comes to police tactics and training? You can get in touch with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Chief Lewis, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, earlier you talked, we were just talking about a traffic stop or some situation like that, and you said you've seen things go from 0 to 100 in a really remarkably short period of time, and I imagine a lot of police officers have seen that. And the question I have, with all the training that an officer has, you see that you have that 0 to 100 thing, you know, it's a second, it's 2 seconds, it's a very short period of time. And an officer is expected to make a lot of decisions within that period of time. What are those decisions, and what are they basing them on?
Well, they're basing, to a large extent, on the conduct of the suspect. You know, we do a lot of training. We give them a lot of tools to use. But in the end, a lot of times, the decision is really made by the person they're dealing with. I mean, we would like to always talk everyone down. And the majority of officers in this country will never be in any type of fatal incident. There's 700,000 police officers and around 500 fatal incidents a year, so well under 0.1%. So most will go through their career without having a fatal incident, but many will go through their career having an incident where there is physical confrontation with suspects. And so they're looking for the behavior of that suspect and the person they're dealing with. Can they talk them down? Can they figure out what the issue is that set them off? Because often it's not us that set them off. There's something else going on in their life, and we just ended up kind of being the trigger because we were just one more thing piled onto them that they just had enough. And so if you can figure that out, often you can talk them down from that. Then the other issue, of course, in society is so often we have people that either have a mental illness issue or they have some type of, whether it's a drug dependency or an alcohol dependency, and sometimes the trigger may be their addiction and not so much anything we did.
So how do you prepare an officer with all that training and everything for those split-second moments? Is there any way you can really prepare somebody for that?
Well, you do the best by walking them through the process. We do a lot of scenario-based incidents now, so we take them in and we do almost like a TV game where they're looking through a variety of scenarios, shoot, don't shoot, and we're testing them on what can happen. And they come out of some of these scenarios with very high raised blood pressure because they can get it's very realistic when they're doing it. So we put them through as many of those as we can. So if they face it on the street, they've somewhat experienced it, though in another area. We constantly train on incidents that occur around the country. It's just like the incidents that have occurred in the last few weeks that have gotten a lot of media attention. Those are talked about in our briefings every day, and the officers talk about what would you have done? Do you see something that could have been done differently? And we try to learn from what's going on, not necessarily learning from all mistakes, because there may not have been mistakes made. That's hard to say. But they're going through those same scenarios, and what would you do if you were put in that same situation? And they talk through that.
And then, so let's say a situation happens. Somebody gets killed by an officer. What is the protocol that's in place for after these moments happen? What's the review of what happened and so forth?
Well, let me give you my example. About 15 years ago, I shot someone back in California. And the person didn't die, but it was a case of, well, I heard a radio broadcast of a double homicide, and the two women had been stabbed with a 12-inch blade knife. And I saw the man walking down the street still carrying that knife. And so I walked behind him for probably a block and a half trying to get him to drop the knife, and he just would not drop the knife. And, of course, a lot of people are coming out of the woodwork, and they're standing in their front yards, and he finally runs towards the front yard where there's a family with kids. And so I shot him before he could get to those kids. Now, then what happened to me, that night, I was there, and I was actually on my way home. I was done with my shift. I was there till late in the evening going through interviews just like a suspect. And frankly, in some respects, felt like a suspect because I was given my rights. I was questioned about what I did, why I did it. And once that process was done, 36 hours later, I was in the office of a psychiatrist, and I was going through a battery of psychological tests to see whether or not I was fit to be put back on duty. And then you go through the whole issue of Could I have done something different? Is there some way I could have gotten that knife away from him without shooting him? Because you know you're going to be in the newspaper. You know you're going to possibly face some type of civil suit or criminal charges. And you're in the front of the newspaper, and that's tough on your family. So you're seeing your family. And in my case, you know, everything was fine at this scene. Kind of like on TV, they're asking me questions, I'm getting straight answers, I'm good. But I go back to the station, I call my wife to tell her I'm not coming home because of what happened. And as soon as I heard her voice, I look down and my right hand is shaking. And on, I forget that, it's as vivid as the day it happened. And I remember looking at my hand thinking, my God, what's going on here? And it's just a natural reaction to the body once it comes down. And the wife's voice is what set me off. So you go through some almost psychological things after doing that. So it's not like on TV. You don't go out to the tavern, have a few drinks with the guys, and talk about it. That's not how it works. It can be a very stressful time for officers.
We've got a very short time left here, but I do want to ask, as you take your experiences and the training that you've received and work on, and you see the conversations taking place around the country, what is missing from the public conversation now about policing that you would like to have more attention paid to?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind that less than 0.1% of officers were ever involved in these incidents, so we've got to be careful about painting a broad brush. We've got to remember that the officers are doing a lot in very tough neighborhoods. We've got a lot of neighborhoods that have a lot of problems, high poverty rates, high unemployment, a history of criminal activity in some families, and those things build up, and we've got to figure out a way to take the level of that down. It's not just a policing issue. And the idea that it's all about the police, people are just wrong, that's the easy out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with James Lewis, Interim Chief of Police at the Appleton Police Department.
Coming up after the news, we look at what agencies Governor Walker may have been referring to yesterday when he expressed interest in consolidating state government agencies in the coming year.
And remember, you can support conversations like this, like the conversation you've just been listening to on Central Time, with your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio. We bring you in-depth news, culture, and coverage every single day because of pledges and support from people like you. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's the end of the year. Great time to think about the value you've gotten from Wisconsin Public Radio all year long. And then make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. And thank you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, along with Jean Purcell. Coming up, the country and state are becoming more diverse, and it's perhaps most noticeable in some of Wisconsin's more rural areas. We'll hear about that later on. First, Governor Walker said yesterday that he's considering the consolidation of some state agencies in the coming year. He didn't give specifics about which agencies. We'll look into that a little bit more. Governor Walker's administration also expressed interest of getting rid of what he calls rarely used state panels. He's here with us to talk about possible mergers and the process of merging agencies is Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, what's the thinking behind the possible consolidation of some agencies?
You know, reorganization is sort of an element of our political culture. We generally have politicians who say what we need to do is we need to reorganize the government. And reorganization is a kind of a code word for cutting fat, cutting duplication, cutting costs. But generally speaking, if you go back to the history of reorganization of the federal government, there have been lots of reorganizations, but they generally don't save money. They might improve management. And maybe the best example is the Department of Homeland Security, which was a reaction to September 11th. And was it a good thing to create? Sure. It's sort of like chicken soup. It doesn't hurt. But on the other hand, is, let's say, the TSA or the Secret Service better coordinating with each other? Probably not that much.
Well, this is speculation at this point, but do you have any idea about what possible agencies could be considered for merging consolidation?
Well, some people will remember that Governor Doyle had created, I think it was called the Department of Children or Department of Children and Families. I might not have the title quite right. He carved it out of a larger Health and Human Services Department. So in other words, from one department, he created two. I wouldn't be surprised if Governor Walker would suggest that coordination of all services to individuals in need would be better done through one organization. And so you have one secretary and one office of legislative liaison and so on. But the line bureaus, the programmatically oriented bureaus based on various state laws and federal programs, that wouldn't change very much. But there might be some modest savings.
Well, last session, the GOP suggested merging the Department of Safety and Professional Services with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Now, Governor Walker has already said he's not necessarily thinking about that this time around, but why was he looking at those two last time?
Well, I suppose one could make an argument that if you're engaging in agriculture and consumer protection and trade, that you're engaging in regulation, regulation of people, regulation of businesses, enforcing rights, having inspectors, for example. I suppose one could make an argument that the old Department of Regulation and Licensing, the new one that you mentioned, the new name, that that department also engages in credentialing and professional licensing and regulation of professions, that somehow there's a kind of an overlap in the thrust. I suppose one could make that argument. I tend to agree with Governor Walker that it seems to be a bit of a stretch.
So we've got Governor Walker looking at merging some state agencies. He's also looking at getting rid of some boards altogether. A couple of these that are of note, the Transportation Projects Commission, which is, I gather, the first stop for highway projects before they move on up the food chain. That seems like kind of a big one to get rid of. What do you think is going on with that?
Well, when we're dealing with the issue of advisory committees, citizen committees, commissions, I think the only correct answer when we talk about whether to abolish them or not is it all depends. You know, there is no one formula. For example, just because an organization has met recently doesn't mean it's important, or vice versa, that it hasn't met recently, that doesn't mean it's unimportant. For example, the way I would look at it is, does this advisory committee, does this commission, does it improve public administration, and more importantly, does it improve the commitment to the public interest? In other words, is this a method of facilitating citizen participation in government, citizen advisory committees? In other words, a way to sort of negate the built-in advantages that the stakeholders of an agency might have. In other words, the people who are regulated by that agency. It's really unclear from the list that was mentioned in the paper and then the one that you mentioned whether these are important for citizen participation for the public interest or not.
And would you say that same argument holds true for another agency, or rather a board that's getting a bit more notice as we talk about this? This is the governor's own Pardon Advisory Board.
Right. This is a really interesting case. And sort of, Veronica, I like that you're zeroing in on, in a sense, some principles of good government. After all, our state constitution gives the governor, I believe it's a totally unlimited power to pardon, just like I believe the federal constitution gives the president the total power to pardon. And going back to Governor Lucey, governors tended to do it just sort of on an almost, I guess you'd say, ad hoc basis. But after Lucey, it became much more formalized that there was a process for applying for a pardon, and there was an advisory board and a committee of civil servants who would look at the applications and who would make a recommendation if it seems to be a good idea or a bad idea for pardon, leaving the power, of course, to the governor. And so I think one could make an argument that maybe it improves the process of reviewing pardon applications to have it. But on the other hand, Governor Walker has not done much pardoning. And so perhaps the argument that would be in his mind is, I rarely pardon, so why do I need a pardon processing board or pardon advisory board? But I think it gets back to the it all depends principle. Is this helpful or not helpful, whether or not it's met recently?
Now, Governor Walker, he said he wants to get some of these boards that are rarely used, the ones we've mentioned, the Pardon Advisory Board, the transportation projects are ones that are being singled out because they do get more use or they have a higher profile. But as someone who's worked in government and watches government, are there a lot of these boards that simply don't don't often get used, are kind of superfluous.
Veronica, my guess is if you were to take the state statutes, in other words, the code of state laws and the code of administrative regulations, and put in a search for council or advisory board or committee, I think you'd be astonished at what your results would be. I would guess that there are a couple thousand of those at least required by law or by administrative rule. You know, when I was in the legislature, there would sort of be common that somebody would have an amendment to a bill that would say, if we're creating a new program, then let's have an advisory committee. Let's have a citizen participation committee. And so these things tend to proliferate whether they're needed or not. And I think the governor's desire to cull the list, or at least to look at the list, is a healthy principle of good government.
Now, Governor Walker has said that mergers, now consolidating state agencies like he's looking to do, would allow him to eliminate positions at the top of these agencies and therefore save money. What kind of money-saving potential do you think there is there?
I think it's minute. I think it's sort of, for each of us taxpayers, it's probably a dime. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic. You know, good organization is important. And we as Americans, we understand what an organization chart is. And we understand sort of the hierarchy of power and that a secretary oversees various bureaus. But if, let's say, you're merging two cabinet departments, so you're going from two secretaries to one, two deputy secretaries to one, the legislative liaison to one, and so on, that's only about half a dozen positions. I mean, otherwise, you need all the bureaus, and you need to coordinate amongst the bureaus. So I suspect it's a pretty small number. Now, a lot of people think that government should follow the pattern of business administration, and it's very typical in business administration that the number of direct reports to a CEO, in other words, the number of people who report to the CIO, who can in a sense walk in on him at any time because he or she supervises them. Generally speaking, in business administration, there's a perception that it ought not be more than about half a dozen, maximum 10. That if a CEO, whether in government or in business administration, has more than, let's say, 10 direct reports, then they really can't supervise them. That's way too many. So I would guess that the governor's instincts are that maybe there are too many direct reports right now and that he'd want to reduce it. But that doesn't necessarily reduce the size of government. And the best example is Jimmy Carter, who campaigned for president. One of his themes was that when he was governor of Georgia, that he reduced the number of state departments from several hundred to something like 8. And that didn't really reduce the size of government. He just created these sort of super departments of direct reports. And whether it's a good thing or not is really a kind of a chicken soup answer.
And briefly, Mordecai, how contentious do you think this idea to consolidate is likely to be?
Well, generally speaking, all Americans in all parties, regardless of ideology, are in favor of efficiency in government. After all, that's what public administration exists to do. I suspect that given that there will be a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, that their view of economy and efficiency will tilt to the right of the political spectrum, which is understandable, that they want smaller government, less government, lower taxes, don't like big bureaucracies. So I would suspect that we're going to see a relatively substantial effort. The governor will sort of make one offer, and I wouldn't be surprised if the legislature antes up and one-ups him by abolishing more things, because that would reflect Republican-conservative ideology.
Mordecai, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee. Governor Walker said yesterday that he's considering consolidating government agencies in the state in the coming year, and he'll announce them in February.
Coming up, diversity is growing in Wisconsin and around the country, and some of the largest growth is in rural areas far from the usual metropolitan centers of diversity. But first, it is our year-end membership drive. I'm Gene Purcell here with Veronica Rickert, and it's the listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio year-end membership drive. Time for you to think about how much you've appreciated Wisconsin Public Radio programming during 2014 and how we know you'd like to help keep us going strong in 2015. So right now we're asking you to take some action with your gift at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Just two more pledges to go. Two more pledges to reach our goal for this hour in about the next 5 minutes. Give
to WPR to support the programs that you rely on. And here's another great reason to give.
That's right. We've got two tickets available. You will be entered to win two tickets on a Wisconsin Public Radio trip when you make a gift of any amount. Of course, you're not required to make a pledge to enter the drawing for those tickets. But if you make a pledge, it's that much easier. You'd get to choose among the trips to Washington, D.C., or France, or a cruise along the Alaskan coast.
A big thank you if you've already given, but if you haven't, the time is now. Give at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
During the last segment, we heard about a topic that's pretty close to home for most of us, a discussion of what the proposed budget for the state of Wisconsin might look like for the next 2 years, and a pretty in-depth discussion of what it might mean in terms of changes to some state agencies, what some of those possibilities might look like, and a really good example of the work that we do here every single day on Central Time, much of which is focused directly at Wisconsin. Wisconsin information for Wisconsin listeners. And that's what we're all about every day here on Central Time.
Your support makes the many topics we cover every day on the show possible. Choose a gift amount that works for you, that feels comfortable in your budget, and then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And remember, you get to decide the amount of your pledge. That is the way that pledging on public radio works. Every single pledge matters. Every single pledge helps to pay for the programs you love here on Wisconsin Public Radio. When you make your pledge, ask for the limited edition 2015 WPR calendar. It features historic photos of WPR throughout the years, and it's great, actually. It's yours for a gift of $120 or more. That's just $10 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a critical resource for the state, and the only way that it's going to be maintained in the long term is to have people who support it. I think it's great to be able to hear what is happening in various parts of the world. I think it's critical to have that resource available, whether we use it every day or not. I like being part of the system that is supporting WPR. Being a supporter of WPR is important for everyone so that they can make use of the resource that is available in our state. I'm Doug Nelson from Pewaukee, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me as a sustainer of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you know, Doug's exactly right. It is important for everyone to make that pledge, make that support at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. I'm Gene Purcell, back with Veronica Rickard, and we're asking for your support of WPR during our year-end membership drive. And perhaps your gift will be $10 or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose is exactly the right amount.
When you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you can be assured that we always have your interests at heart. We can continue to serve our listeners and communities because of the support we get from our members, including the 600 members of WPR's 9XM Leadership Circle.
Now, the 9XM Leadership Circle members support Wisconsin Public Radio with gifts of $1,200 or more every single year. That's $100 a month. So if that's something that fits into your budget, make this leadership gift now. WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
When you support WPR, you're supporting the Wisconsin idea to spread the resources of the university across the entire state. Not every state has an idea like that, and not every state has the high-quality programs you enjoy daily on Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's right, and if you've traveled around the country, if you've sampled other public radio, you know that is true. Wisconsin Public Radio is one of the great things about Wisconsin. It's something to really take pride in. And you can join forces with many other Wisconsinites right now and make that contribution. WPR.org is our website, or give us a call at 888-202-2552.
And when you give, you'll be entered in a drawing for two tickets to go on a WPR trip of your choice. A pledge of any amount is your chance to enjoy the very best of Washington, D.C., a visit to France, or exploring Alaska.
And look at that. We've made our goal. We are exactly where we need to be right now. So big thank you to all of you who called, who made a pledge, who pledged online. We really can't do it without you. So thanks for that hour. If you'd like to make a pledge, you can still get in on it, WPR.org or 888 888- 202-252. And as always, thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio.